All right, very good. Well, I'm delighted to be here to talk about my current career, which is public health, together with my long-term career, which is laboratory medicine, pathology, and even longer-term career, which is informatics. So we have a very interesting intersection that's going on that can pull a lot of this information together. Now, pathology and public health actually have a lot in common. They're really both about studying disease. Pathology studies disease in individuals. Public health looks at patterns of disease in populations and how to detect and prevent that disease. They both emphasize data and process. But public health is in itself very diverse. And it talks about improving the public's health from a variety of ways of looking at the public's health. It takes a population point of view rather than looking at an individual patient. Where in medicine, we're always thinking about, you know, I've got this patient I'm looking at slides for, reviewing a lab test for, kind of an individual one-by-one point of view. The public health point of view is, I've got these 10 million patients I've got to take care of today. How do I go about doing that? How do I go about protecting your health and improving it? Sometimes people confuse public health with using public funds to give health care to people. And running a public hospital system is not public health. That's running a public hospital system. Public health is caring for the overall population on a wider basis. A lot of different subtopics, early warning systems, e-notification, and basically about ascertaining, we're trying to figure out what's going on with the health of the population. We act to make sure that that is improved, and then we assure by building systems protections into the system to assure the health of the population. One of the first well-documented public health initiatives was in the mid-1800s when a London physician took a handle off a pump that he felt might be causing the cholera epidemic and managed to make the epidemic go away. Pathology also is very diverse. We've got surgical pathology where we're doing individual personal service. Clinical pathology is somewhat of a broader population-based approach where we're trying to assure that the assays that are being run in the laboratory are useful for our whole population that is being served by the laboratory. Forensic, you know, why did they die? And then, but it turns out that we also produce a lot of information that's very important to understanding what's going on with the public's health and to protecting the public's health. And that information needs to get from our laboratories to the public health department. And for each subspecialty in pathology, we can help public health in a different way. Within surgical pathology, certainly feeding tumor diagnoses to the tumor registry has been long an application of importance, and now we're getting better at automating that. Clinical pathology, identifying infectious diseases, and looking at patterns in the population, surveillance of various things that will indicate the epidemic outbreak. And forensic pathology is very important as well in terms of even looking at things like injury and violence. The patterns of trauma in the population to suggest what can be done to protect against that. In fact, the impetus to require seatbelts in automobiles in the United States largely came out of both forensic pathology and then public health, recognizing that it could save a lot of lives. And there are a lot of other ways that we interact. Public health labs are, in fact, the interaction where you have a laboratory that's serving public health purposes. We may discover things in the laboratory or the research lab which may impact on public health policy. And then we have personnel that move back and forth, where we have folks that have been long-term clinical laboratorians or so on who have gone into public health and vice versa. And that way we share knowledge. Well, the first example really of automated transfer from a laboratory to a public health agency of coded information was of tumor diagnosis to the cancer registry. People often think, well, wasn't sending salmonella diagnosed cases things that, you know, reportable diseases over, wasn't that done earlier? Actually, this one was back in about 1976, actually, where SNOMED-coded diagnoses were automatically sent to a tumor registry. Interestingly enough, it was done at the MGH. But it's taken a very long time for others to pick up that model. And recently, we've seen more standards being published and grants and projects going on to make that more of a standard practice. I think it's now, I believe it's Florida and some other places that are saying this is the way you have to report to tumor registries. But this is certainly complicated by the fact that we typically in surgical pathology put our entire report into one blob of text. And the tumor registry really needs the information about staging and other sorts of things broken out in a more granular fashion. And that whole topic of surgical pathology and tumor registries is a whole lecture that I don't have time to give this afternoon. So I'm going to tend to more focus on clinical laboratory interactions with public health. And basically here, in what we call generically electronic laboratory reporting, there's software that either sitting on the laboratory information system or on a separate system that selects what reports need to go to public health, sends them over to the health department surveillance system. You can also select other things. We mentioned, we'll talk later on about antimicrobial susceptibility testing reports or ordering patterns or other things. There's a lot of other interesting things there, but the big emphasis up till now has been what's called reportable disease, basically mostly infectious diseases which are required by law to be reported to public health. And even though laboratories as a whole generally do very well, even when they report manually to public health, just automating it in this fashion, some studies have shown that it as much as doubles the rate of reporting. So instead of having to figure out what cases to be reported, writing them on a piece of paper and faxing them over to public health, the automated transmittal can be every day or even several times a day. It's certainly more complete because people don't have to remember that this particular organism is a reportable illness. Lab staff don't have to spend time scurrying around to do it. It's more accurate. We don't have to worry about hand transcription or so on. Also, it turns out that HIPAA has a regulation. Well, it's a two-part thing. One is HIPAA says if you're reporting to public health, you don't have to get the patient's permission to do that. It's an exemption from HIPAA for public health activities. But it says you still have to keep a log of what it is you sent to public health. And I suspect many folks that are sending manual faxes to their local department, local health department, aren't keeping up with that, whereas the electronic laboratory reporting does keep up with it. I did want to mention the medical examiner reports to public health to let us know about serious infectious diseases, to let us know about trauma, other sorts of things. And basically, here we have a direct transmission of case reports from the coroner's system, coroner's information system, to the epidemiology systems in our department. Now, it's best if that's fully automated. For a while, we actually had a fully automated system in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, then they changed servers over at the coroner's department, haven't quite got it fully automated again. But if it's not fully automated, as you know, it may be a day or two late, and sometimes important cases are delayed. But this has been very helpful in telling us about certain cases of infectious disease, that, such as some pediatric flu cases, such as other cases where we were worried about atypical organisms and being able to follow up on them promptly. And there are really two different categories of data that we're talking about of interest here. One is I've mostly been talking up till now about the identified disease cases, whether they're clinical lab, tumor diagnosis, coroners, or so on. And then also case reports where a clinician says, oh, this is a reportable disease, I should tell public health about it. That comes in on the one side of the graph. The other side is the findings in large populations. And there we're looking at patterns of observations in the whole, as much of the population as we can. For example, we see now 50% of the emergency department visits in Los Angeles County. We get data every day on them. We get data that has been de-identified, so we don't have to worry about confidentiality concerns. But by bringing in all of these emergency department data, we can look at patterns of symptoms and so on. Well, this isn't strictly speaking pathology, but you know, what's the definition of pathology? Anyone want to venture? My favorite definition, it's what a pathologist does. So that's what I'm doing, so this is part of pathology now. At any rate, so we get emergency department data, we get data from over-the-counter, or this is lab orders, we get data from over-the-counter medications. So when someone goes in and buys a cold remedy, or someone goes in and buys a fever thermometer, we get data on that the next day and can see, you know, if the number of fever thermometers being sold triples, we have some indication that there may be a febrile problem in the community. Now, as I get in this data, just on the previous slide just had a single simple line, but it's a very complex process to process the data from its source through until we can use it in a public health system. We have to convert the format to being something that the standard tools can handle. We may have to collate it from several sources to bring together one patient, have to figure out how to handle the text as to what it means. Codes need to be translated into standard codes like Loenken-Stomed. We filter it to make sure it actually does need to go to public health. And then in some cases, some jurisdictions, some areas, one has to route the specimens to whether it goes to which public health department. For example, we get a data feed from Quest Laboratories in our area, and we have actually a tool that's sitting on our server that sorts out whether that data coming in is for us or needs to go to San Diego County, in which case we forward it to San Diego County. So it's multiple steps. And how does that clinical lab data get to the public health, more specifically? Now, some laboratory information systems we deal with actually are able to, within the laboratory information system, extract the reportables, apply the Loenken-Stomed coding, and basically send us a fully formed report, HL7 report. And that can get over to us by a whole range of different transport mechanisms. I mean, I've told people often, the transport mechanisms needs to be secure, so email is not kosher. Many others are fine. Carrier pigeon doesn't work because it's not reliable enough. And so we have people sending us data by various mechanisms. And then we put it into our electronic lab reporting system and eventually into our disease surveillance system. Now, other laboratory information systems, like the bottom box there, all they're able to do is produce an HL7 output of all the results. You know, the potassiums, the CBCs, everything gets dumped out that port. And on the bottom, this bottom box here, we have what we call an edge server or a gateway or whatever that filters those results and picks out the cases that are really reportable and forwards those on to us. In other cases, that function could be provided by a provider lab link vendor. And there's a number of vendors of those, what we used to call physician office lab links, we're now calling provider lab links. But they could, since they're getting a complete HL7 from that lab, they could filter off the reportables and send it on to public health. We've certainly talked with some of these vendors and be delighted to work with them. So far, I don't know of a jurisdiction that has actually implemented one of these links. A third way would be through the RIO, the Regional Health Information Organization. And the most spectacular success of that has been the Regenstrief Network in Indiana, where they have a good chunk of the state is the reportable diseases come in from the hospitals, from the various other laboratories, filtered through the Regenstrief RIO system, and that then goes out to public health. Well, we gather a lot of different data. I mean, I've talked about much of it, but various ways of getting reportable diseases, and then we follow up on those by epidemiologists and so on. Various ways of looking at symptoms in populations. In addition to what I've mentioned, the ED and so on, we also look at nurse call complaints. When someone calls up a large nurse call network in our area, we'll see a summary of the call. And looking, you know, parsing free text and looking for patterns is an interesting challenge. And then there's many other data sources as well. Another one that we look at is ambulance services, where the 911 dispatch records. ReadyNet is actually a way of looking at ED volumes in a more all-encompassing basis. In the near future, we're going to have a connection to a complete emergency department record. If I'd given this lecture 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, I would have said, well, next month we're going to have it. But unfortunately, the interface has been bogged down in a hospital legal department for the last 30 months. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. Unfortunately, one of the difficulties is that there's some hospitals that don't understand the importance of this work. But in any case, most hospitals have been very cooperative, though. This is just as one exception. But we're also looking at ambulatory, clinical, and hospital records. Basically, when a physician records a diagnosis that's reportable in an EMR, why shouldn't that be coming automatically over to public health? If the EMR can have the smarts to recognize what the diagnosis is and have a flag in the database that says, okay, send to public health. Now, opinions differ as whether we should, you know, pop up a window for the clinicians, say, report this or not. But since it's a legal requirement to report it, one can say, don't even bother to, you know, we could probably tell them it's being reported, but it's not something that they really have a lot of choice about. But the point is that their usual choice is to not remember that it's reportable and it doesn't get to us at all. And then various granular hospital systems may have information that's of great importance to population surveillance. Now, using that additional lab data, the de-identified data, there's a lot of things we might look at. We haven't really so far, but we think that there's some potential here. Looking at ordering patterns, if there's a doubling in the number of blood cultures that are done, that probably means something. Looking at antibiogram patterns, especially the MRSA problem, other multiply drug-resistant bugs. A lot of interest in the community in this. Looking at patterns of results has been something that's been less delved into, but if you saw a sudden spike in ALT values, maybe somebody had a large party, I don't know. But at any rate, it would be interesting in your thoughts on this, how we might use kind of overall masses of lab data to look at population surveillance. So some of the keys of what we do with here is we do this as a byproduct. There's no additional data, no additional work that goes on to gather this data. It's happening as a byproduct in the background. No human being needs to think about doing anything to make this happen. It's automated. It happens right away. It's relevant. We're not getting a lot of garbage. We're not transferring billing data, which is usually, you know, designed to maximize reimbursement as opposed to represent what's going on with a patient. We will translate the data as it comes, so that typically no one is running native in Loink and SNOMED in their laboratory information system, but we have built translation tables to every one of the 11 laboratory information systems we're connected to. Informatics is a really key tool in work of public health today. And the real-time population health surveillance is sometimes called syndromic surveillance. We're now getting data from 35 emergency departments every day. And the data is summarized and analyzed 7 days a week, goes out to 105 staff. And it also can be used not only for looking for emergent things like a spike in respiratory illness or so on, it also can be used for case finding and assessment of other sorts of issues that come up. Now, this shows kind of the growth where September of 2005, there were still a fair number of areas of the county which were not well covered by the ED surveillance system. And now we have a much better rate of coverage on the right-hand side by ED surveillance. That is, basically, if you go to an emergency department, what's your probability of going to one that is included in the ED surveillance system? So we automatically categorize these complaints to a particular syndrome just by a simple word search. There's not complicated artificial intelligence here. We can track those over time. We look for statistical changes, and we're really looking for changes from baseline. We're not looking for individual cases. We're looking for an aggregate, you know, increase in a particular kind of complaint. We look at GI, respiratory, rash, neurological. During the winter, we look at influenza-like illness as a subset of respiratory. During the summer, we look at heat, although most would claim that Los Angeles doesn't have much heat, but we have enough to cause people some discomfort. And other kinds of syndromes are quite possible. And so we, basically, I think this this is just the pattern of proportion of influenza-like illness visits to emergency departments from back in March of 2003 until last summer. And it's been continued since then, actually, that we have another higher spike of flu than the last several weeks. This is the pattern we see when we look at the RODS website, which we access. Now, RODS is actually a tool that developed by the University of Pittsburgh, and this particular application of it is to look at the National Retail Data Monitoring system, look at patterns of pharmaceutical use, over-the-counter drug use. I think we're up to 60 to 70% of our pharmacies in Los Angeles County participate in this system now. So we will see if there's an unusual pattern of purchase of a particular medication, where it's about 18 classes of medication, we'll see a different color. And here there's a little red area. Let's see, I don't know if we could see it here. I can see it on this screen, but yeah, right in there. There's a little area of red which suggests that something is going on right in that local area that people decided to go to the pharmacy and get this particular medication. And again, we review that 7 days a week. And then we put all of our findings on the syndromic side, the population health side, together into this report. We list the now 35 hospitals, and we also talk about whether we saw anything in over-the-counter or Biosense or ReadyNet or SatScan, which is another statistical tool, coroners or veterinary reports. So we pull together all manner of data. And in this case, SatScan, even though we didn't see anything within the hospitals, SatScan, which is kind of a looks at the whole county at one time, said there was a cluster of gastroenteritis cases in a particular region of the county, in the service planning area 4. Okay, we've, over the years, connected more and more hospitals and emergency departments. This yellow line here are the emergency departments that have been connected to our surveillance systems. This is the number of hospitals and laboratories. And basically, we're now up to 11. The way of count, we at one time we were counting, we have one hospital laboratory that actually covers 6 hospitals. So at this time this graph was made, that was being counted as 6. It's now counted as 1. So in any case, we're now up to 11 separate laboratories that we're serving with this, that we're receiving data daily. We have probably 20 in the pipeline and probably 3 or 4 within a couple of months of implementation. So it's been a very encouraging progress. And then this is just, you know, this isn't just Los Angeles County. Every place in the country needs to do this. And some are farther ahead than others. New York is probably farther ahead than anyone. New York City and New York State is farther ahead than anyone. But, you know, you do need to talk to your local public health department, say, you know, are you ready to get data from, you know, electronic data? What sort of format do you want? There's a lot of technical jargon here about what versions and so on. HL7 version 251 is what we seem to be moving towards. Also talk, even perhaps more important, is talk to the vendor of your laboratory information system and say, okay, do you have a public health information interface module? Or, and what does it do? Does it, can it put out data that's what the local public health wants? One thing that I've been hearing from laboratory information system vendors is they, and from laboratories, is they say, well, every state has different requirements. I think that's basically represents that the states don't understand what they need to ask for. And I'm kind of on a campaign to get the states to ask for the same thing. So anything I can do along that way to help your local jurisdiction to get with the program, I would be happy to do. Even if, you know, if the local laboratory information system has a way of sending out all results and all the results in HL7231, then you can take the edge server approach that I mentioned. That's a somewhat more costly and complicated approach, but if the vendor can't produce a list of just the ones going to public health, but only of any everything, then one has to use essentially a piece of middleware. So how are the laboratory information system vendors doing? And I'm mainly, my knowledge is based on working with the biggest laboratories in Los Angeles. So if in many cases laboratory information system vendors don't happen to have large installations in LA, so I don't have much knowledge of what they can do. Certainly the largest commercial labs, like especially LabCorp and Quest, can provide HL7. Some of them provide Loikens Snowman coding. ARUP, we've been using an older interface from them for some years. We aim to move to a more current interface very soon, or fairly soon. We do know that SunQuest and SoftLab have modules that have the filtering and translation systems available. We've worked extensively with the SunQuest software because, as it turns out, we probably have 15 or 20 SunQuest sites in Los Angeles County. So that's been really our first major push. SoftLab, we have one hospital in the county, and I've reviewed specs, and it looks like it will do it, but we haven't yet implemented anything. With some vendors of Meditech and Cerner, I'm getting a basic HL7 output. Basically, they send to the edge server everything that the lab produces. And then the filtering and translation is done in an external box. Have corresponded with McKesson, but don't really have a response from them yet as to what their capabilities are. We haven't yet worked with a lot. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other labs, lab information system vendors that are not even on this list that we haven't worked with. So we do know some of these have sites in Los Angeles County, but again, they haven't been the largest sites. So you see, it can be very much, in our approach, implementing these systems has been very much a basis of working with the particular vendor that was in that each laboratory, because based on that, the capabilities will be different and how we have to implement it will be different. Well, now, public health labs are a different animal somewhat. I mean, they're a laboratory, but they're kind of a clinical laboratory, but they're kind of not. I mean, they do clinical testing, but they also do environmental testing. Well, there's a lot of different requirements for doing environmental testing. And by the way, they do newborn screening in many cases, and newborn screening is really just a different operational model altogether than clinical testing. They also have often a unique set of regulations. For example, in California, to work in a public health lab, you have to have a special public health license. You can't just take a general med tech license and work in a public health lab as a microbiologist. And sometimes a name does make a difference. What I mean here is that this term LIMS, these are laboratory information management systems that tend to originate in pharmaceutical research industrial settings. And laboratory information systems, at LISs, tend to come from the clinical realm. And this is just, this may be different in Europe, but at least in the United States, this seems to be the case. And unfortunately, we've had public health labs have particularly decided, well, we're going to install some LIMS to run our public health lab. And they've had some challenge with that. I mean, one widely purchased product that was purchased by quite a number of state public health labs, the product doesn't have a patient table. That is, it can handle specimens, but if you wanted to tie them actually to a patient, well, that's a custom modification. And, you know, for maybe that works for the environmental testing, but for the clinical testing, it's a bit of a problem. So one has to look carefully at how where a laboratory information system has come from, whether it's basically a research system or a clinical system, in terms of what its capabilities are likely to be. Well, another issue that we've seen recently is the religion of open source. I mean, there's a number of folks in public health that have decided that open source will be the panacea. And, I mean, they could be correct, but there's others that really believe that open source is an important addition to our toolkits and can't be assumed that it will solve every problem. There are a few interesting open source projects underway. A open source laboratory information system actually being developed for use in public health labs in Minnesota and Iowa, and it's not actually operational yet in the public health labs, but they now have it operational in two clinical laboratories in the country of Vietnam. So there may be some very interesting things coming out of this. And there's also open source electronic medical records that are being used in a number of resource poor countries, especially through what's called the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief. So lots of interesting things going on. Well, how else can we as pathologists, laboratorians help public health? We do have a very important skill set. You know, really, pathology training, and especially pathology experience, prepares one surprisingly well for public health. It's really not necessary to have specialized public health training, such as an MPH or so on, to make a worthwhile contribution. So just, I mean, if you've been somebody that's been hiding behind the microscope for 10 years, then maybe you don't have the nature for it. But if one is especially a generalist pathologist, especially on the clinical pathology side, I think there's a lot of skills that you have. Now, how can we contribute? Well, we can go to work in public health. We can direct the public health laboratory. We can be in communicable diseases. We can do informatics. We can be the health officer. And there's a lot of opportunities for volunteering, especially in the third world. And then we're actually having a roundtable at the CAP 08 meeting about the pathologist practicing public health. So look forward to hearing from you. Any questions that anyone has?
Yeah. The Public Health Commission in New York City has been particularly aggressive in terms of seeking information and the question relates to the boundaries between public and private information. One thing in particular is by mandating requiring a reference acts and a hospital act to provide quite the close information.
Patients basically with high glucose levels, some of whom are untreated, some of whom, in fact, may be treated but being non-compliant and so forth. So give us an idea about the boundaries between what's fair game for laboratory data in the public health sector and what's not fair game.
Now, that what's fair game, I think there will be different opinions. You know, one of the mandates of public health is to look at chronic diseases such as diabetes and obesity and so on. And there's a constant discussion within the public health. How do we go about getting data on the diabetics? I mean, another one to be looked at is the now is he getting these glucose values with identifiers, or is he getting them de-identified? Yeah, that is a very aggressive stance. We're encouraging getting more and more data from laboratories in terms of looking at how to manage some of these diseases. But I think part of it also is the local legislative climate. I presume the legislature has given him the authority to do that. I don't think we would have the authority in California to do that without additional legislation.
We know in California are the most restricted environments, so they're most regulated.
Well, New York and California are the most restrictive, but New York is so many light years ahead of us in terms of more restrictive. I mean, the laboratories in New York are regulated up the wazoo. I mean, several years ago, I was director of a laboratory, a portion of a laboratory in Utah, and we, from time to time, did some testing on patients in New York, and I actually had to get a New York clinical laboratory director's license to be able to do these few tests that we were doing. So California is. Yeah, I would say, you know, New York is way up here as far as regulation. California's here, and maybe the rest of the country is here, but, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Is it hemoglobin A1C? Okay. Well, and I think that's probably, that's certainly more defensible than glucose is. But hemoglobin A1Cs have been reportable in some respects as a HEDIS measure for quite a number of years, so... I think it's. I can certainly see the argument whereby one would say you ought to. That's a way of looking at glucose at diabetes, and you have a mandate to monitor chronic diseases as well. So, let's see. I hope I haven't insulted all of you. I know there were certain segments that I did, but no. Appreciate your attention. Did you have a question? Or, no.
Yes. Come to the microphone, please. Thanks.
Since there's been so much talk about Health 2.0, and I know that there are websites that people can go and report the symptoms they think they're having and see what other symptoms other people are reporting in their area, what's the opinion of that in public health? Is there a belief that there's a benefit in that, or is it seen as having any value?
Well, certainly having people report the symptoms they're having directly is something we have been advocating in terms of foodborne illness. And I spent a good portion of last week getting straightened out about a page that we've just put up at Los Angeles that allows people to type in the fact that they have had a foodborne illness, and then the case will go directly into our disease surveillance system. In terms of having them see what other people are reporting or so on, there may be some value in that. I think that the one concern might be that you may develop a bit of a herd mentality, and a bunch of people are developing the symptom and there's nothing going on, but you have, you know, we know that, for example, our syndromic surveillance, which depends on people's chief complaints as they come in the emergency department, the moment there's a news report about something going on, whatever the disease, we basically know that that portion of the syndromic surveillance will be useless, because people will come in complaining of something which they really don't have because they've heard about it on the news. So it's a two-edged sword. I think it's like every other tool, we'll kind of learn how it's best applied. I don't think there's anything we can do particularly to stop it from happening, so, you know, we just kind of have to observe. Other questions?